following paid program does not represent the views of North Shore 104.9.
Welcome to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial. This morning during the program, your host, Mark Friedman, may discuss specific financial planning and investment ideas. These discussions are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations. Financial planning and investment advice is offered through Friedman Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor located in Peabody, Massachusetts. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, a member of FINRA and SIPC. Friedman Financial is a separate entity from LPL Financial. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Always consult a certified financial planner professional, qualified attorney, or tax advisor prior to investing to determine what is appropriate for you.
Listeners to this radio show should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the mutual fund, variable annuity, and variable annuity subaccounts. To obtain a prospectus, you may contact Friedman Financial or your financial advisor. Prospectuses should be read carefully before making a potential investment.
And now, here's the host of Dollars and Cents, Mark Friedman of Friedman Financial.
Good morning and welcome to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. My name is Mark Friedman, President and CEO of Friedman Financial, located in Peabody, Massachusetts, right across the street from the North Shore Mall and just above Daniela's Ristorante. It is time to talk about financial literacy. We're talking about anything and everything that has to do with money, and we're learning every day how many people across the country are so ill-informed about just some of the basic financial planning and financial literacy questions that we need to do a better job to make sure that the public is educated, because frankly, folks, it's not happening in our schools. So joining me this morning is our Director of Financial Planning, Christian Karcher. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for being up so early in the morning. There are so many areas that we could talk about with financial literacy. I know we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about a few topics, and then where Marion is going to join us, my business partner. She will be in at the 8:30 hour, coming in to join us with some financial literacy items as well. But, you know, financial literacy can address issues from anybody who is actually able to count. It financial literacy, it doesn't really matter whether you're 2 years old or 102 years old. But the one thing that we're always introduced to, the first type of financial literacy question that we might have, has to do with the George Washingtons that we get on a piece of paper, which is just cash. You know, whether it's pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters, dollar bills, $100 bills, we really need to understand cash. And I know you've given this some thought about how we can start to think about cash a little bit differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that we take for granted, but as far as financial topics go, cash is first and foremost. It's the most important. Without cash, you can't go to the store and buy anything that you want. You can't budget. It is the foundation of any financial literacy course or understanding of the financial world.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is I was driving to work a couple days ago, and I noticed that there's this ATM, this Bank of America ATM, over in Middleton near Richardson's Ice Cream. And I thought to myself, when's the last time I went to the ATM machine? I used to go there weekly because that's where I used to walk around. I had my cash. But I find that fewer and fewer people are actually holding physical cash, yet the way we use cash is something that's very important, whether it's in a digital form. And I'm not talking about cryptocurrencies here. I'm talking about cash. I'm talking about, you know, your debit card, how we use credit cards. All of that is part of the cash experience. And then there's, where do you deposit your cash? In checking accounts or savings accounts or money market accounts or CDs and all of that. You got some thoughts around that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting time to live because in the past decade or so, the paradigm of keeping cash has completely changed. It used to be back in the 90s when I was born, I don't want to date myself, but you could go to the bank and you could put money into the bank and you could get 4 or 5%. And at the time, inflation was 2 or 3%. And so you were actually making money on your money. But over the last decade, that has really shifted with the adjustment in how they do the interest rates. And so now you get almost nothing on your cash. And now we have inflation also starting to creep up and really hitting people over the head. And so we have a situation.
So wait a second. Before you even get to even further, I want to ask you about something that was there, which is you were still making money on your money. Maybe you can explain to our listeners a little bit about what inflation really means. That's called inflation risk. Right? I mean, if we're earning 2% on our money, but inflation is at 2%, did we make any money? Now, mathematically, someone might say, no, you didn't make money. But people say, but I have 2% money more than what I had yesterday. Perhaps you can add some financial advice in a language people can understand to that.
Right. And so that's the hardest part, is to say, okay, my $100 grew to $102. But when we peel back the onion there, we say, what does that $100 buy you? And with inflation, if inflation was 2% in that case, that $102 that you earned might only still buy you what was $100 worth of groceries a year before. And so that's where that inflation number kicks in. And so currently we're looking at, you know, inflation is looking to be like 6 to 8% right now. So that $100 becomes 6 to 8% less valuable in a year. So if you're earning zero on your cash and inflation is 6 to 8%, your $100 is now really worth more like $95.
Well, another way to look at it is, if it costs $3 to buy a gallon of milk, and a year from now it costs $3.50 to buy a gallon of milk, and all you earned was 1% on your money, $3, 1% on $3 is 30 cents.
Yep.
Is that right? No, that's, sorry,
that's
3 cents. I'm sorry, I'm losing my thought here. So
3 cents,
1% on $30 is 3 cents.
On $3, it's 3 cents.
I'm just messing up. So it's early in the morning, folks. You know, we're trying to make this as easy as possible, and I'm trying to put this in some financial advice in a language people you can understand. So if something costs $3 and you earn 1% on your $3, you've made 3 cents on your $3. So if something costs $3 today, and a year from now it costs $3.50, but all you got was 1% on your money, essentially you're having to pay an extra 47 cents to buy that same product, because all you got was 3 cents of inflation. So 3 cents on your interest on your money, but inflation was so much higher. And it's a challenge that we're battled with here every day. We're seeing the cost of goods, of cars, of oil, of food, of everything going up.
Yeah.
Now, how do we begin to think about what we do with our cash though, Christian? I mean, so well, how do we approach that?
And that's a hard question, because we get a lot of people coming in and saying, you know, my cash is earning nothing in the bank and I want to see if I can invest some of it. Well, we have to take a step back, because like I said at the start of the show, cash is the basis of the economy. You can't take a stock that you have invested and go hand in a share of Apple to pay for your groceries. It doesn't work like that. And so if you need cash to survive and you need cash to prepare and be ready for you if you have an emergency and need to spend it, we do need to keep some money in cash. So it's always important to have what we call an emergency fund. That's 3 to 6 months of your living expenses.
But what if I don't know my expenses?
Well, then you have to figure out your expenses. And once you do that, you can kind of get a sense as to how much you need in a bank account. And another thing with inflation creeping up is maybe it's time to re-examine your emergency fund. You might have been comfortable with a, say, $50,000 emergency fund. But with your go look at your expenses again, because it's very likely that they went up with, you know, the cost of groceries and gas. Maybe you actually need a little bit more in cash, counterintuitively, to make sure that you have an appropriate emergency fund that covers that 3 to 6 months of living expenses.
Yeah, but that's it. Cash, I mean, we take for granted how easy it is to use cash, because it's like playing with, it's like going to the casino now, because we hand over a debit card and money just comes out of our account. And it's just like cash. I mean, the same thing can happen with a credit card, too. At least when you use a debit card, and maybe it's best, maybe you want to explain that, Christian, the difference between a debit card and a credit card.
Sure. So a debit card is going to pull money right out of your bank account. You go into the store, you have $1,000 in the bank. You go into the store, you buy $100 in groceries. You give them that debit card, they will immediately move it over from your bank account. Your $3,000 is now $2,900. And that's an easy way to track that. Now, a credit card can get a little bit tricky if you're not staying on top of things. Luckily, with technology, a lot of us have been able to say, okay, we can actually track our credit card and say, okay, how much is it right now? And I've got my app on my Chase app, and I can pull it up and see, you know, I've spent $2,000 this month. But if you go in and you give them your credit card, you get to keep the $3,000 of cash in the bank. But in a month, the credit card company comes and bills you for the $100 of groceries you just spent. And now you've got to pay it out of the cash. Where people can get into trouble is when you put a bunch of stuff on that credit card and the bill comes and you don't know what that bill is going to be. Because you've just been running around town swiping, buying Christmas presents, whatever it is. And all of a sudden, you don't have enough money in the bank to pay that credit card bill. So what do you do?
Well, you pay a payment. You make a payment on the credit card. And without making that payment, with making just a payment, you're paying interest, a very large interest payment, on the amount of money that you haven't yet paid off. And one of the things that we find that's interesting is that for those that just love to use their credit card, and they let it all accumulate, and they say, all right, maybe I spent $2,000 this month on my credit card, and I have $5,000 sitting in the bank. And they could very well easily write a check for $2,000 to pay off the credit card. Yet they think, well, if I write a check for $2,000 to pay off my credit card, then I'll only have $3,000 left in the bank. And they wonder, maybe I'll just pay $500. And I'll pay $500 the next month and $500 the next month to pay off the credit card. But the problem is they don't stop using the credit card. So the balance grows. And we're continuously paying interest payments. And I think one of the things that people don't understand is the impact of interest payments and what that does. So recently, there was a national financial capability study done by the FINRA Investor Education Foundation. And they asked, they do this every year to try to get a sense as to how people think about money to see how financially literate they are. So let me ask the question, and then I'm going to ask the question. I'll tell you what the four multiple choice answers were, and then perhaps you'll give us the right answer. I hope, Christian.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll see. Here we go. So here's question number one. Suppose you have $100 in a savings account, earning 2% interest a year. After 5 years, how much would you have in the bank? Would you have more than $102? Exactly $102, less than $102, or I don't know. So once again, I'll repeat the question for you. You have $100 in a savings account earning 2% interest a year. After 5 years, would you have more than $102, exactly $102, less than $102, or I have no idea?
Well, so let's break it down, because I think a lot of listeners will say, oh, well, this is an easy question. We'll get to the answer of being more than $102, but let's figure out how we can look at it so that if we had a little bit more of a complex scenario, we would know the step-by-step process. So we first got to look at, okay, we have $100 in the bank. We're earning 2%. So let's figure out how much interest in 1 year are we going to get with 2% interest on $100. And in that case, that is $2.
$2.
So after the first year, we're already at that 102 mark. So if we've got four more years of interest, no matter what that number is going to calculate out to, we're going to get 2% each of those years. So you're going to get $2, maybe a little bit more, because now you're also getting what's called compound interest, where we're getting interest on the $2 of interest you already earned. So knowing that, and knowing that we've got 5 years where we're going to get at least $2 of interest, we know we are over $102 in the bank account.
He's so smart. Thanks for walking us through that one. All right, let's see if I can turn up the question here a little bit. We've got about a couple of minutes before we take a break. Here comes the question. Remember, here it is. Imagine that the interest rate on your savings account is 1% per year, and inflation is 2% a year. After 1 year, with the money in the account buy more than it does today, exactly the same as it does today, or less than it does today? So we're saying you could earn 1% on your money in the bank, yet inflation is growing at 2%. At the end of the year, could you buy more than what you did a year ago, the same or less?
Well, and so you can buy less in that case. And that goes back to the discussion we just had about inflation. If inflation is running higher than the interest rate in your bank, at the end of the year, the money in your bank, even though you earn some interest, is really going to be able to purchase less goods or less things out there at the end of the
year. So you're saying with interest rates being as low as they are and inflation being at the rate that it is, it's going to continue to cost us more money to buy items year after year. Yet if we invest money in the bank, we'll never be able to keep up with the pace of inflation.
Money in the bank will not keep up with the pace of inflation at the current rate.
So what is an investor to do? Well, we're going to work on giving you that answer and more. When we get back, you're listening to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. Hi, this is Mark Friedman of Friedman Financial. With all that's gone on over the past couple years, perhaps retirement is sounding pretty good. But how can you focus on the future when you're so busy juggling the day-to-day? It's time for a real plan, a plan you can define, a plan you can track, and a plan you can modify as things change. At Friedman Financial, that's what we do. We know that planning for your retirement can be overwhelming, but with more than 50 years of experience, we know what you're going through. We're experienced and we're fiduciaries. We listen and we collaborate with your best interests in mind. You don't have to do this alone anymore. Turn to us for answers to your why, how, and what if questions. If now is the time to get serious about your retirement, please give us a call. We're Friedman Financial of Peabody. Financial advice in a language you can understand.
Visit FriedmanFinancial.com. That's Friedman, two E's and a D, Financial.com. Friedman Financial is a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
It's not about the money, money, money. We don't need your money, money, money.
Welcome back to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. I'm Mark Friedman, President and CEO of Friedman Financial, located in Peabody, Massachusetts, right across the street from the North Shore Mall. I'm joined by our Director of Financial Planning, Christian Karcher, this morning. Christian, how are you?
Good morning, Mark. I'm doing well.
Good. Christian's providing us a lot of great financial literacy information. It's one of those things that, frankly, you and I both know. We don't get taught this stuff in school. And if not us, you and I, Christian, or even parents for that matter, how are our children going to know how to think about investing? And in fact, a study recently came out that we saw that sadly said only 40% of adults use a budget and track spending. More than 3 out of 4 adults live paycheck to paycheck. About half of Americans maintain 3 months' expenses in emergency fund or less. And more than a quarter of Americans have no savings at all. The collective debt best illustrates why we need to increase financial literacy in America. More than a third of U.S. adults worry that they won't save enough by retirement. And that's a scary prospect since pensions are no longer the typical medium for you getting a retirement income. Now it's up to people to draw upon Social Security. Some people have had a pension, and some still may, but very few people do. But for the most part, it's up to you to draw money from whether it's your 401k plan, your retirement plan, personal savings, maybe if you're fortunate enough, an inheritance you receive, maybe cash from a downsized house, or even cash in the bank. But as we talked about earlier, with cash paying next to nothing and inflation growing at a rate that we haven't seen in a while, though I don't think it's going to stay at that level, money in the bank is basically money you're almost guaranteed to lose, though it doesn't feel like that in a tangible sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that number might continue to grow just ever so slightly, but the value of what you can buy with that number continues to drop as inflation rises.
Yeah, so we've been looking at some of these test questions. There's a financial capabilities study that's put out by FINRA, which is the financial I don't even know what the acronym is for FINRA. I should know it. But it's the FINRA is a regulatory body that supervises broker-dealers. But it's called the FINRA Investor Education Foundation. You can find this. You can Google it yourself. If you go to usfinancialcapability.org, we're going through a quiz that is offered for people to take. And so the past couple questions that we asked in the first segment were cash-related questions, what to do with money in the bank, how to understand the difference between interest and inflation. I want to move a little bit towards bonds. And bonds, and as we hear about in the news, interest rates are going up. So the question here says, Christian, if interest rates rise, what will typically happen to bond prices? Will they rise? Will they fall? Will they stay the same? Or is there just simply no relationship between interest rates rising and bond prices?
So this is one that confuses a lot of people. And the answer is, when interest rates are rising, bond prices are going to actually fall. And you think, well, if the bond is paying more interest, why would it fall? Well, the answer is the bond that you own was issued previously on a fixed term. So let's say that you got a bond. You paid $10,000 for the bond, and it is earning 2%. That's what you agreed upon. It's a 10-year bond. So you agreed to get 2% interest for the next 10 years from a bond from, let's say, Coca-Cola. Okay? So now, let's say interest rates rise a little bit, and now Coke has to pay 4% on a bond, and they have to issue a new bond.
But what about the bonds that they had before?
Well, they still got to lock those in. So they had just sold you a bond for $10,000, and they agreed to pay 2%.
For 10 years.
For 10 years. And they're not going to give that up, because now if they had to get that $10,000 from someone else, they would have to pay 4%. So if someone else can buy a bond from Coca-Cola that pays 4%, your bond, if you wanted to sell it, that only pays 2%, is less valuable.
So let me be sure I understand this. So I bought a bond. Yep. That's going to pay me 2% for 10 years. So every year, I'm going to get 2% of my money for 10 years.
Yes.
And then I heard Coca-Cola, or any other company for that matter, is now offering a bond that's going to pay 4% for 10 years. Well, I want to get rid of my bond that's going to pay me 2% and, of course, go buy a 4% bond. Can't I just get my $10,000 back and buy the 4% bond?
No, you can't. So you can't just go back to Coca-Cola and say, here's the bond back. I want one of those new shiny 4% bonds. What you would have to do is you would have to find a buyer for your bond. And of course, if a buyer for your bond can go ahead and buy the 4% bond, they're certainly not going to buy your 2% bond unless you give them a discount, which is why your bond price would go down as interest rates rise.
That's right. And does the same thing happen on the other side if interest rates are dropping?
It absolutely does. So if you look at some of the bonds that you saw issued back in the 80s, they were paying 12, 13, 14, 15%. As interest rates dropped over the coming decades, if you had a really long bond, if you got a 18, 19% bond for a 30-year treasury, so a bond that was issued by the U.S. government, the value of that bond that was paying 17, 18, 19% skyrocketed when interest rates fell from 17, 18, 19% to 4 and 5%. And so there is that inverse relationship as well if interest rates fall.
So wait a second. If I'm hearing from you that if interest rates rise, the value of bonds would go down, and we feel pretty certain that interest rates are going to rise in the future, why would anybody own bonds?
Well, bonds do pay some interest. That's the important part. So the other alternative to a bond might be cash, but cash pays even less. And the reason you want bonds or cash in a retirement portfolio is they do not have the volatility of the stock market. The stock market being, you know, your S&P 500. Those stocks and bond, or those stocks can go up and down very dramatically. So back in 2020, you know, the stock market dropped 33% over the course of a month. Bonds don't usually drop that significantly. They might drop 5 or 10% in something like that, and they're quicker to recover from
I think there is that. Yes, I see that, but I'm thinking to myself, if I just bought it, we just said a few minutes ago, if we spend $10,000 for a bond and it was paying 2% for 10 years and interest rates went up, you just told me my 2% bond would be worth less. But if I know that that's going to happen, the bond I buy today, if interest rates are going to go up, if that bond's going to be worth less, I wonder to myself, why would I buy it? But the real reason I think we buy bonds is because bonds are not a tactical strategy. Bonds are not something that we trade. It's not something that we buy and sell on an ongoing basis. You buy bonds to get the interest. You don't buy bonds for what the bond is priced every day in the paper or online. You buy bonds to hold them till maturity. So as long as the quality of your bond is one that will be able to pay out the $10,000 at the end of 10 years and you get your 2% for the 10 years, you need not worry about the day-to-day fluctuations. It's holding on to it until the maturity. But it's difficult to do that when bonds get priced daily, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the great one of the things that some financial advisors will talk about is if you had a giant sign above your house that listed the value of your home every day.
How about every 5 minutes?
Every 5 minutes, during the business hours. You know, you might have a little bit more trepidation about your house. You go, oh my goodness, you come home from work, you're carrying in the groceries, and you look up and it's $10,000 less than it was the morning before.
Mm-hmm.
So not looking at that, the volatility in price kind of helps people not think about the fluctuation of their financial assets in such emotional terms. But that does happen with bonds because they have to be priced each and every day.
But years ago, probably even before you were born, when people wanted to buy stocks or bonds, they actually got paper certificates, both bond certificates and stock certificates. And they would take those certificates and shove them in a safe deposit box. And all they cared about was getting their dividend check or their interest check. They didn't even know how much their stock or their bond was fluctuating value because there was really no way to know. As long as they got their interest check or their dividend check, that's all that mattered. Now that everything is reported, second to second, minute to minute, there's added anxiety that goes along with that. So when people start thinking about asking us, why should I have bonds in my portfolio? There's a reason for it. There's a reason we're doing it for the income, not for what the value of, not for a trading strategy to get out of a bond or into a bond on a day-to-day basis. It's for the income. All right. One other question here as it relates to stocks. And people ask us all the time this question, but this is part of the financial literacy quiz. It's a true or false question, Christian. So, you got one way, what's going to be right or wrong.
Okay, that's
ready.
Easy. 50-50.
50-50 chance. All right, here it is. Buying a single company's stock usually provides a safer return than a stock mutual fund. True or false?
That is false.
Well, but what if it's Tesla?
That is extra false.
So what if it's Apple or GE or all these blue chip companies, these the aristocrat companies that have been around for so long? Isn't it safer to just buy an individual stock?
Well, it's not. So the good thing about buying a mutual fund or a whole group of stocks, that is, it's a fund that holds every one of the big stocks, is you get to diversify a little bit. You're owning a little bit of all these companies. If you just own Apple and something goes horribly wrong, and let's say all of the Apple's processing chips are in a single storage facility in China, and all of a sudden it burns down to the ground. All the chips are gone. They have to restart. They can't sell iPhones for 6 months. That is something that is a very specific risk to the Apple company. Now, if you owned a mutual fund, it might be impacted a little bit because Apple is so big, and you might own a little bit of Apple. But you might also own Samsung or Google, and all of a sudden, now their phone sales are going to increase, and so they get a little bump up because this happened to Apple. And so having the diversified mix is a lot safer because you do not have as much of the risk in a single company having something catastrophic occur.
But what is the possibility? Maybe I'll expand it to another question. Is there a greater chance of losing all your money in a single stock or losing all of your money in a mutual fund?
Well, there's a much greater risk of losing all of your money in a single stock.
Why is that?
Well, because single companies go bankrupt very frequently. The entire U.S. economy, as of yet, has never gone completely bankrupt. And if it did, we'd be a lot less concerned about our portfolio values and a lot more concerned about how many canned goods you have stored in your kitchen.
Right. But a mutual fund carries one of the things that I like about mutual funds, package products, exchange-traded funds, index funds, is that they provide an investor a few things. Number one is tremendous diversification. Even just within one mutual fund, you have a bunch of positions in a mutual fund. And one of the rules with most mutual funds is that you can't have 5% of your money in any one given security, unless the prospectus allows for that. But generally, that's 5%. And if 5% is the maximum, well, hey, that's at least 20 stocks in a portfolio to get you to 100. So you get number one is diversification. Number two is you get professional money management. If you or I wanted to buy any stock. What makes us decide what price do we buy a stock at? Because we read something in the newspaper, Kramer said it was a good buy. My buddy, you know, that I go to the baseball game with says, hey, I heard about this stock. Is that a good enough reason to buy it? Well, when a professional money manager is buying it in a mutual fund, his team or her team, their team, has people that go to visit the companies. They kick the tires. They dig into the reports. And they make a decision as to how much money should we pay for this stock. When it hits a particular price going up, should we sell it? Or if it drops to a price, do we buy more or do we sell it there? They have disciplines. You and I buying an individual stock are usually emotionally attached, not rationally attached. So you get professional money management. You get diversification. You also get daily pricing. So you can see what your mutual fund is priced and easy liquidity of getting out of that money. There's daily pricing and liquidity. Those are all very, very important things to have. Buying real estate might sound like an exciting thing to do, but do you get liquidity there?
Absolutely not.
Do you get diversification by owning a two-family house? You don't own that either. You don't have that in an individual stock either. So we're trying to help you think smarter when it comes to your money. Financial advice in a language you can understand. Well, I want to thank Christian for being our guest on our show today for the first half of the segment. We are going to bid adieu to you and welcome Marion Gilman into the studio in just a few minutes when we get back. Thank you again, Christian. And before we break away, I want to remind everybody about our free weekly newsletter. It comes out each and every Friday, 10:30 in the morning. It's called Planning Pointers. Where can you find the information for signing up for Planning Pointers, Christian?
You can find the information for signing up for Planning Pointers if you go to FriedmanFinancial.com. That's F-R-E.
Oh, come on. It's
Financial.
It's Friedman, two E's and a D, Financial.com.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go to the bottom of any page. Put in your name and your email address.
Oh, that's important.
And we'll get you signed up. Christian, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a great day, everybody. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back for more Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. Hi, this is Mark Friedman, president of Friedman Financial and host of Dollars and Cents, heard here Sundays from 8 to 9 a.m. Let's face it, your retirement will be nothing like your parents. Your life won't be based on a fixed income, and instead, in today's world, it will be up to you to make tax-smart decisions on your 401k, your IRAs, and the rest of your investment portfolio. And it's all with a goal of using this money to support your spending needs for the rest of your life. This is serious business, and at Friedman Financial, we can help. With more than 50 years of experience serving this local community, we deliver financial advice in a language you can understand. Visit us at FriedmanFinancial.com. That's Friedman, two E's and a D, Financial.com. Let's make your retirement all that you've dreamed it could be.
Visit FriedmanFinancial.com. That's Friedman, two E's and a D, Financial.com. Friedman Financial is a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Money, 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 money. From that money machine.
Welcome back to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. My name is Mark Friedman, president and CEO of Friedman Financial, located in Peabody, Massachusetts. Right across the street from the North Shore Mall and just above Daniela's Ristorante, where they have the absolute best garlic bread. And it comes free with your meal, so don't miss out on that. We are here in studio. We just had Christian Karcher, our Director of Financial Planning, join us for the first couple segments talking about financial literacy. And we just think it's such an important topic to try to give people some guidance. So what does it mean to develop some good financial literacy skills? Something that certainly isn't being taught in the school. And so to help us out, I told you in the second half, I would have my business partner, Marion Gilman, join us in studio. And here she is. Marion, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well. You up and ready for this?
I'm ready. Always ready.
Good.
There you go.
So when you think about, you know, financial literacy, I think one of the first things that people really need to understand is how money comes into a household and money goes out of a household.
Absolutely. And I know there's that dreaded word of budget. And so we don't call it a budget around here. We call it a financial plan. So you want to plan for your cash flow. Same thing as a budget, say, but the budget sounds restrictive, whereas planning just sounds like good advice.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because many people come in here asking if we're going to put them on a budget or they're going to have a budget. And our what do we generally tell people?
Well, you know, no, absolutely not. There's no reason that you have to write down every single solitary thing that you spend, particularly if you're spending within your means. The most important component of a financial plan is to know what's coming in and to spend less, a little bit less, than what is coming in. So live within your means, and that's critical in today's day and age.
You know, there used to be a musical called the Charlie Brown Musical, and one of the songs in the Charlie Brown Musical was called Happiness Is.
Okay.
And the song had Happiness Is, Three Kinds of Ice Cream, Happiness Is, A Day at the Park. But when I went to Babson College, my accounting professor, Professor Bruno, used to say happiness is positive cash flow.
And that is so important. I would say that's absolutely the
But truth. What is positive cash flow, Mary?
Positive cash flow is exactly what we just said. You actually spend less than what comes into the household. So you need to know what your expenses are. And, you know, when you think of planning for your finances, you need to know what your basic expenses are, your committed expenses each and every month, and then your desired expenses every month. And we might call that a need versus a want. And you want to talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, but before we get there, let's stick with this positive cash flow thing.
Okay.
Because many people will think that they go to a financial planner to help them get out of debt. And generally, that is not what a financial... The best type of client for a financial planner starts with having positive cash flow.
Absolutely.
If you are unable to save any money based upon what you're collecting, financial planning with a financial planner generally isn't the first step for you, is it?
No, it's not. So, and actually, if you are in debt... You need somebody who is focused on that area of personal finance. And it could be a debt consolidator. It could be, you know, something to that effect. That is not necessarily what a financial planning professional does.
Right, but there's good debt and bad debt. I mean, having a debt for a mortgage
Very
is one
true.
Thing. But right. carrying a debt on a credit card that you're paying 25 and 30% interest on, it's probably bad debt.
Definitely not good debt. I mean, what you want to remember is that if all of your money every month is going just to pay the interest on a credit card, you are really too far in debt, considerably too far in debt.
Right.
And you need somebody to help you get out of that debt before you go to a financial plan.
And one of the goals is to watch, I mean, people say watch your wealth grow. And most people don't think if they've saved $5,000 or $50,000, they don't look at it as their wealth. But it's just watching your money grow, watching your investments grow. And one of the ways to help your money grow is, like you just said, Marion, is focusing on this need versus a want. And many people need to reassess what it is that they're spending money on. And maybe you can help us understand the difference between a need and a want.
Well, you know, we all start off by saying, okay, well, we need to have a roof over our head. You know, these are some of the basic needs. We need to have food every day. We might need to have transportation if we live somewhere where we can't walk to work or take public transportation. You need to be able to get to a job. So there are certain things that the basics of life that need to be covered, and those are your needs. Going to Starbucks every morning to get a cup of coffee, although that's not going to change your life if you do that or not do that. However, going to Starbucks to get a cup of coffee every morning is not a need. You might need coffee, but you can make it at home.
Absolutely.
Or you could go somewhere else that's less expensive. So you got to distinguish between, you know, what your needs are and what your wants.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've learned in this need versus want society, and we've grown into this more of a want society than a need.
Sure.
We want convenience, and we are
Very
willing
true.
To pay for convenience at all costs.
And honestly, if you have the resources to do that, that's great. As long as you're not taking away from your ability to save some money every month, set something aside every month, and your ability to meet all of your expenses each and every month, not build up credit card debt.
So one of the things that I know frustrates many people who are, let's say, who are parents or grandparents, is how they get frustrated when they watch their children, teenagers or 20-year-olds, spend money for conveniences when they want to try to save everything they can. So the best example that I give is I go off to, I teach at some of the high schools sometimes with a personal financial planning program, and I ask the kids, how many of you DoorDash or order stuff via DoorDash? And every hand in the room goes up. And they're willing to pay a convenience fee. Remember when we used to get a pizza delivered? Pizza delivery was free. Remember that? And you just tip the driver?
I do. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now if you want, you can have anything delivered, whether it's Uber Eats or DoorDash or whatever it is. Not only do you pay for the food, you pay a service charge, you pay the DoorDash delivery driver, and then you tip them as well. It's ridiculous how much money they're willing to pay.
It can add 30% to your bill, as I understand.
Easily.
Yeah.
And these are kids who are making $14.25, the minimum wage in Massachusetts, and they think it's okay to tip and pay service charges and all of that. I'll ask them again when I go to a school, I'll say, how many of you use an ATM machine? Every hand goes up in the room. I said, what does it cost to take money out of an ATM machine? And quickly, they'll say to me, it costs either $2, $3, $5 to take money out of an ATM machine. And I have to remind them that it's free to take money out of an ATM machine if you go to the bank where you do your banking. And they go, well, that's not convenient. If I'm going to be at the pizza shop and I need cash, I go to the ATM machine. I said, well, how much money on average do you take out of the ATM machine? And it's usually $20. So they're willing to pay $3 or $4 or $5 to get $20.
Crazy.
That does not make any sense.
Yeah.
So let me switch it to the other side now. We all know that the cost of gas has gone up.
It certainly has.
Dramatically, it's gone up.
Right.
And every morning you will drive by a Costco that has a gas station, and there's a line outside the Costco gas station to save 10 cents on a gallon of gas based upon what the prices are of all the other gas stations around.
And how long do you think they wait in line
with
their motors running and wasting gas?
Exactly.
Right? Is that
exactly.
Right?
Just, well, wait a second. They wait in line with their motors running, waiting for gas to save 10 cents to fill up a 20-gallon tank. So they're looking to save $2, right?
Right.
But take a look. Go ahead and walk around Costco and take a look at the average age of the person that's sitting in a car waiting to save $2. It's not a teenager. It is not a 20-year-old. Who is it, Marion?
It's the older people who grew up during the Depression.
Right.
Who remember having to scrimp and save when they were young.
That's exactly right. They're the ones in line to save $2 while their grandkids are willing to spend $3 at an ATM machine, an extra 30% to get DoorDash, or willing to continue to buy a bottled water at $2 or $4.50 at Fenway Park, or a Starbucks at $3 to $5.
There you go.
That's what we need to address. When we talk about needs versus wants, number one thing with financial literacy is doing our very best to set examples for our children on what needs versus wants look like, and explaining that when you have the resources, you can pay for privilege. You can pay for convenience. But when you don't, you need to be careful.
You certainly do. And honestly, you know, the interesting thing is, I read this interesting statistic the other day. 33% of all millionaires today never made more than $100,000 per year. So think about that. I mean, in today's day and age, they have accumulated over $1 million. That's what a millionaire is, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they never made what we would consider huge salaries. We're talking about people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. They never made more than that, and yet they were able to accumulate $1 million.
And so the secret to that,
savings.
Through the secret to that, is starting to save early. And that when we get
true.
Back, when we get back, we're going to talk about strategies on how you can begin to build up a lifestyle, build a financial plan, even if it's small to start, to get yourself ready for your financial future. You're listening to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. Hi, this is Mark Friedman of Friedman Financial. With all that's gone on over the past couple years, perhaps retirement is sounding pretty good. But how can you focus on the future when you're so busy juggling the day-to-day? It's time for a real plan, a plan you can define, a plan you can track, and a plan you can modify as things change. At Friedman Financial, that's what we do. We know that planning for your retirement can be overwhelming, but with more than 50 years of experience, we know what you're going through. We're experienced and we're fiduciaries. We listen and we collaborate with your best interests in mind. You don't have to do this alone anymore. Turn to us for answers to your why, how, and what if questions. If now is the time to get serious about your retirement, please give us a call. We're Friedman Financial of Peabody. Financial advice in a language you can understand.
Visit FriedmanFinancial.com. That's Friedman, two E's and a D, Financial.com.
Friedman Financial is a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Welcome back to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9. It's Financial Literacy Day. We're talking everything about how to save, how to prepare, how to think a little smarter when it comes to your money. Earlier in the show today, I had my director of financial planning, Kristen Karcher, in the office in the studio with us, talking about some ideas on strategies for cash, thinking about cash and being smart about interest rates and inflation. We then moved on to talking a little bit about interest rates in bonds and what happens when interest rates go up to bonds and what happens with interest rates when they go down. We talked a little bit about that. In the third segment, I welcomed my guest now, Marion Gilman, who's my business partner. And we talked a little bit about the difference between needs and wants and cash flow. And so now we want to share some ideas on how you can start making some money. And people are always thinking about, geez, if I invested in something, how long would it take to double? And it's actually an easy mathematical formula. And so, Marion, I'm going to let you kind of explain it to everybody, how we can start to plan on how we double our money.
Okay, well, so here we go. So the easiest way to look at this, there is a rule in finance called the Rule of 72. So if you think of what possible interest rate or rate of return I could get on my money over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and let's say that interest rate is 7% approximately. And honestly, if you have a diversified portfolio, yes, the market goes up and down. If you have diversification among stocks and bonds, however, a return of about 7% per year is a very achievable long-term rate of return. So the rule of 72 says, take whatever interest rate or return you're getting on your money and divide that into 72. So if you were getting 7%, you take 7% divided into 72 and you get approximately 10 years. So that would be the number of years it takes for your money to double.
But that's a long time for money to double, Marion. 10 years? I can't wait that long.
Then you're out of luck.
Well,
you potentially, if you want an investment that doubles in 1 year, that could potentially happen.
But you need to get 35% a year.
Well, in one year, you need to get
72%.
Yeah, so you need a big number there.
Yeah.
And sure, that could happen. That has happened in certain years.
That happens
Tesla.
Right, but that happens with a stock. But just as easily, Tesla could go down and you could lose money just as quickly.
That's absolutely right.
But
you need to remember that it works in both directions.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting how people will talk about their big winners. I made 14% of my money this year, or I made 18% or 10%.
And when did they last tell you about their big losers?
They never tell you about that. They will tell you about, and they might even tell you about their portfolio, they'll call it.
Yeah.
Well, chances are they're talking about a portfolio. There's a lot of people who have money that sits in cash. That's earning zero. Money that's sitting in their 401k. Money that might be cash value in a life insurance policy, or money in an annuity, or money in a different type of investment account. What is their real rate of return? People only want to tell you what their rate of return is on the stuff that makes money.
For sure. And as we all know, there are some years when cash makes nothing. I mean, particularly in checking accounts, it's rare that you get any decent interest rate on a checking account, at least over the past, you know, 10 years, say. So we need to take a look at that and say, okay, well, you know, money in the bank, really not going to make 7%. But again, if you had a diversified investment portfolio, that's very achievable.
It's possible. I mean, there's no guarantee there, of course.
That is very true.
No guarantee. And it's so setting up a proper portfolio.
Individual stocks.
And I like to suggest to people that if they're seeking a rate of return that's any type of rate of return beyond like 1 or 2%, the likelihood of achieving that goal has a greater chance of success the longer we remain invested.
That, absolutely. In any one particular year, you can lose money as much as make money. And there's no guarantee. You're absolutely right.
I think a lot of people have asked us, I mean, we've had questions in our office. Look, since August, if you invested your money in August or any time thereafter, you basically had a 0 to -% return. In 6 to 8 months.
In both stocks and bonds.
And bonds, yeah. That is very, very real. I mean, for so many years, we were focused on everybody making so much money, and people forgot that you could actually lose money in an investment portfolio.
And did you know you can actually lose money on real estate, too?
Well,
did you know that?
Well, Christian made a good point in the last segment. You know, people would know that if there was a billboard atop everybody's home that had an ever-changing value on it every 10 minutes that said, here's what the value of your house is today. People would know that, but people don't know. And then again, they say, well, you know, well, Zillow gives me the answer. How many people have actually gone to Zillow and looked at the price, but when they went to sell their house,
it was a very different number. Right?
Look, yeah. It might have been more. It might have been less,
yeah.
But it was a very different number.
Sure.
Zillow was taking an estimate.
Yeah, it's always an estimate with real estate, but there are so many people who look at real estate and say, oh, you can't lose money on real estate, or I've never lost money on real estate. And that's because most people tend to keep their homes and sell in a good market as opposed to a bad market if they can.
But most people also don't consider all of the money that they sunk into their house during that time.
Very true.
To replace a kitchen, replace a floor, a driveway, a roof, a boiler, all of those things, a pool.
You need to look at that not as so much as an investment. At least we say not so much as an investment. However, that's something that you need. It is you know, the roof over your head, as we said initially.
Yeah, I mean, of course we need a place to live.
We need a place.
And it's nice that real estate has held its value and grown in many cases.
So true.
But buying an investment property, that's a whole different game. And look,
yes.
there's another person here on this radio show that talks about buying real estate as an investment property, and you're welcome to listen to his show. But we look at investment property. I mean, actually, the show that he's doing on real estate investing is passive investing. You're giving money to a company that will buy real estate investments. But perhaps you want to buy a two-family house. And you say, well, think about the rent that I could collect. It'll be more than what I'm paying in my mortgage. That's true. But what happens if the toilet explodes? Or there's a leak in the ceiling? Or the grass has to be cut? You are the landlord, and if you're not handy and you're not willing to do that, those are added expenses that you have to lay out.
Right.
And your personal time is money, too.
Most definitely. And, you know, real estate is a whole different scenario. But, again, you should just remember always, whether it's stocks, bonds, real estate, whatever it might be, it can go up and it can go down.
Absolutely. You know, and we've been talking about financial literacy today, and joining me is my business partner, Marion Gilman, to help us talk about that. You know, we talked earlier about needs versus wants and how many people are willing to pay for conveniences. And I know growing up as a kid, and probably you too, Marion, when there were chores to be done around the house, you know, we helped clean the house, we cut the grass, we shoveled the driveway, we weeded the beds, we did all that stuff, right?
Sure.
And today,
you didn't hire anyone to do it.
There was no such thing as hiring people to do that.
Sure.
And we have become, because we've made more money, because we have that excess expense, excess cash flow as more mature folks and people that have put some money aside, we're able to pay for those conveniences. The problem is our kids, they don't know. My daughter, and I've joked about this before on the radio, when we were living in our old house, Mindy was downstairs in the basement, my oldest daughter, and she saw a lawnmower in the basement. And she says, "Why do you have a lawnmower, Dad?" I said, "We have a lawnmower because at our house before that, I used to cut the lawn." "You did? I thought we hire people to do that." And that is part of the cultural problem that we have right now, is our kids don't know how to, what we call, adult. They don't know how to change a tire. They don't know how to do their laundry. They don't know how to do these things.
They don't know how to get started. They need, you know, they expect to be at the level that their parents are, you know, at age, let's say the parents are 45, 50, and they can hire people to do these chores that they don't have the time or inclination to do anymore. So the 25-year-olds also want that luxury because they don't want to do the work. They see their parents doing this. So they don't understand what the parents did to get to where they're at today.
So how do we help those kids?
So you really need to set an example for them and teach them young. I mean, I think that's critical. That you need to start young, give them some responsibility with money. Show them, you know, give them an allowance, say, or give them some sort of money to spend and let them make their own choices. I will tell you, when my son was young and we would go into a store and he absolutely needed a computer game that was on the shelf. I mean, begged, "I need this, Mom." As soon as I said to him, "Well, that's fine. You have money. You can buy that." Somehow he just didn't need it anymore.
Right.
You know, if I bought it, it was great. Him didn't want to spend his own money because he knew he was going to need that money for something else.
It's really, really important that we try to teach our kids some basic skills, but we need to be the ones that set the example. And I know it's so easy for us to not do that, too. It's easy for many of us to go out and buy our kids what they might want. Sometimes they're trying to keep up with the Joneses, too, and that's not the best way to approach it.
No, it's not. But absolutely, I mean, the other thing is you can show them early on what it means to set money aside in an investment account or in a bank account and allow them to see what happens as it grows.
So what happens when people...
get very excited about that.
Yeah, so tell me about that, you know, investing early and what that all looks like.
Well, compound interest is a remarkable thing, and compound interest simply means that you are getting interest on your interest. So think about it. If you set aside $10,000 by the age of 25, say you got your first job, you were able to save, and that account doubles every year. You get a 7% rate of, I'm sorry, doubles in 10 years. You get a 7% rate of return. 10 years, you're going to have, you put it, had $10,000. At age 35, you're going to have $20,000. At age 45, that's $40,000 now. At age 55, we're at $80,000. 65, you now have $160,000. Not a bad deal. Remember, you never saved another cent. It's the power of compound interest. But if you didn't do that till age 45, if you didn't accumulate that $10,000, so now you get $10,000 at 45, $20,000 at 55, and $40,000 at 65. $40,000 versus $160,000.
It's a big difference.
Huge difference. Think of what you could do.
Yeah, it's really the magic of compounding and starting off with any amount of money that you can do, putting money aside.
So true.
That's the secret to it, and there is more and more financial literacy that we can provide to our listeners. We as parents need to set some financial literacy guidelines to our children. We owe it to them, but we are now out of time. It's amazing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Mary needs to say something.
It's critical.
Go, please.
Remember, we are now responsible, and your kids will be responsible for their own retirement. There aren't pensions anymore.
That's for sure.
So you need to be very careful to teach this at a young age.
So I hope that they continue to tune into this show. Thank you for tuning in.
Yes.
Marion, thank you for being here today.
Yeah,
and sign up for the newsletter, FriedmanFinancial.com. Go to the bottom of any page of our newsletter, bottom of any page, put in your name, your email address, and you can sign up for our newsletter that lands every Friday at 10:30 in the morning in your mailbox.
Good tips for financial literacy.
Financial advice in a language you can understand.
There you go.
We're out of here. Everyone have a wonderful day. We'll see you next Sunday from 8 to 9. You're listening to Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial on North Shore 104.9.
Thanks for tuning into Dollars and Cents with Friedman Financial. During the show, specific investments may have been discussed. These discussions are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations. Please consult a certified financial planner, tax professional, or attorney to determine what is appropriate for you. Consider your investment objectives, risk, charges, and expenses of an investment company before investing. That's because investing involves risk, including a loss of principal. A prospectus contains this and other information about mutual funds, variable annuities, and variable annuity subaccounts. Prospectuses should be read carefully before making an investment. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment and financial planning advice is offered through Mark's firm, Friedman Financial, which is a registered investment advisor and a separate entity from LPL. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next Sunday at 8 a.m.
The prior show was a paid program that does not express the views, opinions, or beliefs of North Shore 104.9, the station management, its employees, or staff.